have a new bet for you, Tim, and it is called Train or No Train.
Oh, I'm excited.
The game here is you have 60 seconds to identify whether I'm going to give you a pitch. I'm going to give you a series of pitches, and you're going to tell me whether this was a pitch for an actual TV show or movie that actually got made, or whether it's fake. If it's real and you know what the show or movie was and you give me the name, you get more points. You get 2 points for correctly discerning whether it's real or fake, and you get 5 points if you know the title. And if you get to 25 points before the end of the 60 seconds, you win smug satisfaction for at least 12 hours. These pitches are all train related, if I didn't say that already.
Of course.
All right?
Of course.
All right.
Okay.
Santa kidnaps kids and takes them to the North Pole to indoctrinate them on his existence.
That's a real show.
Yes. Do you know the name?
Do not.
It was a movie, Polar Express. Sexy fembots travel the country solving mysteries.
No, I don't think so.
Correct. That's fake. Love Boat on a nuclear-powered train.
Yes. That's a TV show.
Yes. Super Train.
Super Train. Yes.
Love Boat on a time-traveling train.
Oh, no. I'm going to go no.
Nope, it was real. It was called Time Express. A man, a chimpanzee, a train.
Yes.
Nope, fake. Beefcake U.S. Treasury agents travel the Old West solving mysteries.
That sounds like Wild Wild West.
That is correct. All right. So I have a score of 9 points. So you get, 9 over 25 is 36% smug satisfaction. Would you like to hear the rest of them to see how you might have done if you kept going?
Please.
The cast from Saved by the Bell live and work on a train owned by the rich girl's dad.
Ooh, wow. Was that a made-for-TV movie?
No, it's fake. It's based, I based it on another TV show that wasn't Saved by the Bell that had a similar theme on a boat. White and black comedy legends team up to solve a murder mystery on a train.
Was that a comedy take on Murder on the Orient Express?
No, not really. But it was real. You were right about that, so you get 2 points. Silver Streak, which was Richard Pryor and Gene Wilder. White and black comedy legends team up to solve a financial mystery on a train, and a gorilla on human sexual assault is played for laughs.
I want to say that's not a real thing, but it probably was in the 80s.
Trading Places.
Ah, yes.
Wilford Brimley conducts a train and teaches young people lessons about life.
Ooh, that's believable.
Nope, it was fake. And finally, new Ice Age train powered by perpetual motion energy illuminates viewers as to the exploitation of the working class as essential to the continued functioning of capitalism.
Well, gosh, that sounds like Snowpiercer.
That's correct.
Both a TV show and a movie and a graphic novel, as it turns out.
A graphic novel even. So you would have gotten another 7 points if there had been enough time. So there you go. All right. Yes, those were all train themed. And believe it or not, those two Love Boat on a Train things premiered within 2 months of each other in 1979. The first one, Super Train, almost bankrupted NBC because NBC spent a giant pile of money on it. And it was an incredible, horrible failure. And it combined with the fact that we boycotted the 1980 Olympics because the Soviet Union had invaded Afghanistan. And NBC lost a mint on that. And so between the 1980 Olympics and Super Train, it almost put the Peacock Network out of business. So, and the show was a colossal, horrible failure. If you can imagine Love Boat on a nuclear powered train without any of the charm, without any of the kitschy charm of the original Love Boat, that is what Super Train was like. And I was a child. And let me just tell you, if you wonder why my generation is as screwed up as it is, it's because our entertainment choices were things like Super Train.
It was a classic before its own time, perhaps. Or perhaps not.
Perhaps. And we're back. Thank you for joining us for the Monty Hall Effect. I'm Tolomartz.
And I'm Tim Lloyd.
And we are aerospace buddies for about the last 20 years. But if you're listening to this, hopefully you know that we review science fiction films. And we have one that I think Tim suggested, Snowpiercer.
Yes. Yes. After our last series of, I think, a couple of maybe not so great films, which are fun, we wanted to watch one that was, frankly, thoroughly enjoyable. And Snowpiercer fit the bill.
Absolutely. And I just have to say, I have a bit, I don't want to say I have a man crush on Chris Evans. I just think Chris Evans is cool. Like, the proverbial, I would love to go get a beer with Chris Evans. He just seems like a cool guy. Everything he's been in, he's been great in. He wasn't so great, I guess, in the original Fantastic Four movies, but they weren't really great to begin with. But I mean,
yeah, nobody was really. Yeah.
No, he was. You and I have talked about him before because, of course, he was in Sunshine.
Yes.
The Danny Boyle film as an engineer and as a real engineer's engineer, right? Like, as a recognizable engineer type that you and I work with on a regular basis in our day jobs.
Oh yeah. So,
and he was, I have to say, before we get into Snowpiercer, he was the essential character in the first generation of the MCU. I really think his Captain America was sort of the glue that ran through so much of it. It's just a fundamentally decent guy. He had superpowers, but he wasn't he wasn't unrecognizable. He had a very human connection. And he was just great as Captain America. And I was not a Captain America fan in the comic book years. I always thought Captain America was kind of a square, but I loved his character, and I thought all the Captain America movies were great. And I'm going to stop gushing about Chris Evans now, and talk about Snowpiercer. But I just have to say, I'm up for any movie that's got Chris Evans in it. He's a sign of quality for me.
He's one of the better Chrises of Hollywood of our era. Well, very good. Well, so should we set the scene here, I guess, for Snowpiercer?
Yes, let's.
So we're post-apocalyptic. This backstory kind of gets filled out for the viewers over the course of the movie, but I can sort of summarize it up front because I think it's not all that complicated. Maybe basically. And I guess there is an opening. Is it an opening crawl or a voiceover?
No, it's a crawl, and it's got images of planes with contrails across the sky. Just what we need. More people associating contrails with nefarious stuff, because the world doesn't have enough of that.
Yeah, yeah. So so basically, in an attempt to stop global warming, the scientists of the world have basically used chemtrails, let's just say, to inject aerosols.
Stratospheric aerosol injection.
Yeah, yeah, which is a thing that people have studied as one of these ways to sort of geoengineer our way out of a global warming catastrophe.
I worked for a company that was involved in studying this very phenomena. By the folks who did it were the same folks who brought us Star Wars, aka Strategic Defense Initiative, in the 1980s. And some of those same minds thought it might be a great idea to do some chemical engineering on the upper atmosphere to see if we could solve global warming. And thank God nobody's taken them up on it.
Indeed, indeed. This sort of solution also features maybe somewhat less famously in, I think, Neal Stephenson's latest book, Termination Shock, as well as in one of the more famous episodes of The Simpsons, where Mr. Burns decides to block out the sun, with a similar effect as what we see in Snowpiercer, which is basically it goes horribly wrong. It blocks out way too much of the sun, and the Earth enters an ice age, and the surface of the Earth is uninhabitable at this point.
Yeah, like really, really cold, like Minnesota in January cold, only the whole,
yeah,
whole planet.
Yeah. Or worse, as it seems, and as we find out.
Yeah, I mean, I shouldn't joke. Yes, colder than Minnesota in January. Yeah. Freeze things solid in a short amount of time.
Yeah, yeah. And so the only people that are left alive on the planet are on this train, and we learn later sort of what the point of this train was. It was this sort of really cool perpetual motion-y kind of kind of Vacation Train a little bit. I mean, a little bit, you know, like not unlike Super Train, in being designed to travel around the world through some sort of vaguely hand-wavy explained series of probably bridges over the major oceans of the world. And you can just get on the train, ride around as long as you want to, and then get off again. And it turns out it was the only place to be when the Earth froze over.
Yeah, I think the TV show, because there was a TV show after the movie came out, expounds a little bit more on how the systems work. There's something about it needs to keep moving to stay energized. It's not a nuclear power train in the classic sense. It's got some MacGuffin-ish engine, but the key is it has to keep moving. Once it's going, it has to stay going. I in the TV show, I think it stops, and it's really, 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 really hard to get it started going again if it stops. So they just keep it moving perennially. And you can't just run it on a track forever, which is what I, as an engineer, would do. I'd be like, hey, let's get a little 3-mile-wide track and just run it on that track continuously. But nope, they have to go circling around this frozen wasteland Earth all the time.
Yeah, no tricks like in the movie Speed. You have to find other ways to keep it moving.
Right.
So we're introduced to this train itself in the back of the train. And this is kind of the basic setup is from back to front is sort of the people who are the worst off all the way up to the people who are in charge of everything. It's a very like, it's not even a metaphor. For ratification of society, like it's just there, like it's all laid out.
Yeah, he's like, I'm not worried about this being too on the nose because I'm going to make it real, real, real overt. Like, there's no, you don't need to read any subtleties of this. It's, the cool kids are in the front, and the rest of us are in the back.
Yeah, so we're introduced to Chris Evans. Playing a character named Curtis. And it's
a good everyman name.
Yeah. By the way. You know, Curtis. It's just Curtis. It's pretty clear early on that he's the guy. Being sort of surrounded by people who are maybe a little bit more like visibly malnourished than he is. He's Chris Evans, so obviously he's up to something. They lay a lot of groundwork in terms of, you know, what's the living situation of all of these people kind of crammed into the back of the train. They're living in bunks. They're doing some sort of labor, it seems. And then just kind of stacked in there, families and children and everybody else.
It's not clear to me what labor most of them are actually doing. I get the sense they're almost just, their labor is to just breed and provide occasional human capital to the higher ups. I mean, it wasn't obvious to me what they were doing back
then. Yeah. And occasionally you see, and you see a little bit into the kind of the first act where right as they stage their kind of their break for the front, that there's some sort of materials that are being brought back and forth from the back of the train in barrels. I don't recall if it was made super clear what it was. It kind of doesn't matter, you know.
I think I assumed it was waste to feed the food processing system that works further forward, but I don't know. I don't think they make it clear.
And so the brutal conditions that they're under are made visibly clear by who's this character's name? It was the actor who played Sick Boy in Trainspotting.
Oh, Trainspotting. Yeah, right.
He tries to stop his kid from being taken away.
Right. They come back and they're looking for, they're going to take some kids forward.
Yeah. And it's in a very, I mean, frankly, fairly overt, Nazi Germany reference. They say, we just need to go and take these kids for some medical examinations.
By the way, the actor is Ewan Bremner.
Ewan Bremner, yes.
Who's in Trainspotting.
Yes. He's fantastic.
Who played Sick Boy.
I love that guy. He's a great, great character actor.
Yep.
And so, yeah, so they take his son. Octavia Spencer is also in this. She's fantastic. They take her son as well. And Bremner is caught while trying to stop them from taking his son, and the punishment.
Well, he hits somebody, yeah, yeah. Right? He hits one of the guards, and they do not like
no,
that.
No, no, you shouldn't do that. That's
do not hit the guards.
That's not your job.
Note to self. Yeah.
And so they clamp a metal ring on his hand, open a small porthole in the side of the train, and stick his arm out, and start mm-hmm. counting down. And his arm pretty quickly freezes solid. And then they bring it back in and smash it with a hammer.
Yep. Which is the thing you can do when you freeze something. I mean, you have to get something really, really cold to make it. Like if you dip organic things in liquid nitrogen, you can shatter them with a hammer. Yes, it has to be very, very cold indeed outside to freeze something that solid. But yeah, that's a thing.
It does. Yeah. And yeah, maybe we can come back to the temperature thing when we get to the end of the film, because I have some questions.
So the point is, they are not fooling around. No. This is not a mildly, this is not a totalitarian state with a heart of gold. There's no heart of gold here with these folks. They are not playing around.
There's sort of the opposite of a heart of gold, which is Tilda Swinton, mm-hmm. who plays
Tilda Swinton. Oh my gosh. Yet another amazing, amazing performance. This is an actress who, in any given 5-year time frame, has more amazing performances than most actors or actresses get in an entire lifetime.
Yeah, she plays a character named Minister Mason, who is basically the sort of the right hand of the train, and. She's talked about how she built her character to be sort of a mix of like Margaret Thatcher and Colonel Gaddafi, which comes off really well. It's extremely well played.
Right. Right. A very British, putting Maggie Thatcher at it's Margaret Thatcher, Colonel Gaddafi, Adolf Hitler, and Silvio Berlusconi, but only a Brit would put Margaret Thatcher at the top of that list, and a Brit of a certain age. You know, I first saw her in Orlando, which was just an amazing, amazing film. Yeah. And in some senses, technically science fiction. Oh my God, what a great movie. That was her launching point, her equivalent of Elizabeth, the way Elizabeth was for Kate Blanchett. Anyhow, I digress.
I mean, we could talk about how amazing Tilda Swinton is forever. She gives a speech as poor Ewan Bremner's hand is being frozen off about the importance of knowing your place. And if you're at, you know, it's a fantastic speech. And basically saying, you know, if your job is to be the hat at the top of the head, I'm going to misremember this a little bit, then you should be the hat. But if you're the shoe, you need to be the shoe and be like stepped on, and you shouldn't try to be a hat. And so, she tells everybody in the back of the train, they need to be the shoe. And this whole time, like this in sort of this frighteningly absurd, torture scene, as this man's getting his hand frozen off with a shoe sitting on his head as she's going on about the importance of being a shoe.
Yes. It was funny and horrifying.
As you can probably imagine with a Chris Evans type character in the movie, it's time to stage some sort of escape revolution, something like that. And so he puts together a ragtag band of misfits to go and take on the rest of the train. Fight their plan is basically to fight their way to the front and take over the train.
And don't they use the timing of the doors out of their section into the next section? They figure out the timing of it somehow, right? And they exploit a security weakness of the door system to get through to the next area.
Yeah, it's a great like prison break kind of thing, where it's like, you know, you watch the movements of the guards and the timing of everything, and it's a really nice nod to some kind of throwback to some Prison Break movies there. They're also helped by two other sources along the way. They're helped by John Hurt's character. So John Hurt plays this is shocking for John Hurt. He plays sort of a grumpy old man leader guy. And he's the one who's sort of the kind of the instigator, really, mm-hmm. of the revolt.
He's kind of Chris Evans's mentor,
yeah,
as well as an instigator.
Yeah, and he plays Gilliam is his name. And the other piece of help that they get right before the, I'm going to call it the prison break because that's kind of what it is they get a message delivered mm-hmm. in one of their food rations.
Which are disgusting. It's some gelatinous rectangle of God knows what, although we'll kind of know more later. But it's clearly not tasty. But
no, but highly desired because it's pretty much the only thing you have to eat. And so it becomes, as with any sort of food ration in a place like that, it becomes an object of trade. And I thought it kind of looked a little bit like if you took a like an old fruit roll up, and that kind of like texture a little bit, but then made it squishier and thicker. I don't know.
Yeah, it was like a horrible, nightmarish version of Jell-O to me. Mm-hmm. It was like Jell-O, but not Jell-O you'd want to eat.
No. A terrible aspic.
So there's a message. There's a message in one of these food cubes.
And it's not explained yet where these messages are coming from. But it provides some information about, and this is what tells them about the bullets, right? They have a theory that the guns that the guards are carrying don't have any bullets in them because they used them up in the last revolution, which sets a stage for the audience to recognize that this is not the first time someone has tried to take over the train. But it turns out they're right. These guns have no bullets in them. And so through a combination of realizing that and getting the timing of the guard changes and opening the doors, they successfully, the ragtag band of misfits make their way up into the next train car.
And it becomes sort of progressively easier from a equipment standpoint to get further along. Like there's things that happen in each of the subsequent cars, but it's never as hard physically as it was to get out of that first one.
Yeah. It's maybe not being too kind to this movie to call it a little bit video game-ish, but there are some kind of video game aspects, right? As they sort of level up and they get more, you pick up more weapons along the way and so on.
Yeah. I mean, I would say rather than video game, I would call it more dreamlike. There's definite dreamlike aspects to this. I mean, it's not supposed to be a dream, but the way that the story unfolds and the fact that you're on a literally linear plot, right? Like you can't get more linear than a train. Right.
Yeah.
And that serves a certain dreamlike quality to it, where the episodic nature is inherent to the geometry of the situation in which they find themselves.
Yeah.
And because it's so cold out, it's not like you can go outside and run around. You know, you're not going to run around on the roof of this train because you'd be dead in 30 seconds.
Right. Right. They avoid the one other trope of a movie that takes place on a train, which is a rooftop fight.
Usually with tunnels. It's a rooftop fight with characters where a tunnel is looming. And if both characters don't drop to the deck, they're going to get decapitated.
Yeah.
They avoid that because it's so incredibly space, you know, hostile, like outer space outside the train.
Yeah.
So everything until very late in the movie takes place inside the train.
Well, their kind of first destination, right, is the prison, the actual prison car of this train, which is, I guess, where they stick people who they still need to keep alive for some reason.
They need later. Right.
And so the person that they're looking for is a security specialist. I think I'm going to mispronounce his name, Namgung, I think. And he's in there for being a bad security specialist, probably not following orders or something.
Disappointing them in some way, shape, or form. Yeah. Disappointing the authorities, I get the sense.
It's a fascist regime. They don't really need an excuse. So they freeze.
And the actor, although he is in some ways hard to recognize, is the same guy that played the dad in Parasite, right?
Oh yeah, yeah.
The dad of the itinerant, the family that occupies the rich family's house. So yeah, very almost hard to recognize such a different character. But yeah, same guy, same director, same actor.
Yeah. Yes. Song. What's his name?
Kang Ho.
Song Kang Ho. Yeah. 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 Big. Definitely a partner. Of Bong Joon-ho, and has been in many of his movies.
Bong Joon-ho, who of course made Parasite, won an Oscar for it. You know, as international culture devours all things Korean culture, you know, music, film, whatever. He's a big luminary in that universe.
Oh yeah, yeah.
We were discussing, some friends and I were discussing the fact that like Korea is thrilled to have its culture be so prevalent on the international stage, whereas Japan goes to great efforts to keep its culture off the international stage, with the exception of manga and anime. Like everything else, Japan is like, we don't want to export this to the rest of the world. We don't care if it's popular. In fact, we just assume that the rest of the world doesn't know anything about it, right? Whereas Korea is like, sure, we'll have our boy bands become the most popular in the world. Why not?
Yeah. So they do. The movie does a cool thing, I think, with Namgoong and a couple of other characters, which is that they don't subtitle the things that he says. He speaks Korean throughout the film, and they have these little sort of handheld translators that kind of sort of work some of the time. And I thought that was just different movies have different takes on how to deal with multiple languages. And I thought this was a good solution for this one.
So so one of the plot things about him is that he's an addict, right? And he's an addict to a gum-like substance, right? Or at least that's how it's presented. He's hoarding this gum-like substance, right? Which has addictive properties.
Yeah.
Do you remember what it's called? I don't remember what it's called. It's sort of MacGuffin, but.
Yeah, MacGuffin drug.
But he's always collecting it, and people are assuming it's because he's going to go back to being an addict at some point. In fact, isn't it sort of implied one of the reasons he's locked up is because he's an addict?
Yeah, Cronol is what it's called.
Cronol, that's
yeah.
Right.
And it's sort of explained pretty early on that it's also like highly flammable. That piece of information is sort of laid out there. The various Chekhov's guns that are laid out in this.
I was just gonna say Chekhov's bubble gum.
Chekhov's bubble gum. Yeah, exactly. So he's also imprisoned with his daughter Yona, and so of course he asks for her to be freed as well. She's clairvoyant, which is interesting. Pretty much everything else in this movie is science fiction. Definitely in the realm of science fiction, and there's just this added aspect that she can sometimes see what's around the corner, kind of, or what's on the other side of the next door is how it plays out.
Force sensitive is what they would say in the in the Star Wars universe.
So with his help to open, with Namgoong's help to open the doors, and with Yona's ability to see, what's on the other side of these doors. They continue to make some progress through the train. They discover the source of the nasty food bars.
Oh my God. Great scene. Great scene. But yes, it turns out to be basically squished locusts, right? Or a locust-like bug. They've got these giant tanks, right? Or is it locusts or is it... it's flying things, right?
Yeah, I mean, they kind of look like cockroaches, maybe, or...
I don't know. Some insect is getting ground up and squished and pulped and turned into these food bars. So that's great.
Which is like, I don't know, of all of the revolting things or disturbing things in this movie, I don't know. That's, in my mind, that's maybe not the highest on the list. Because it's protein. Like if you're trapped in a very small space and you need to grow protein to feed a lot of people, bugs are actually a pretty good way to go.
You know, if things get weird enough on this planet, our grandchildren's grandchildren might just be eating bug-based proteins, like in Blade Runner 2049, right, where he's eating they're eating larva-based proteins.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Exactly. And at least they go to all the trouble of making it not look like bug.
Well, that's true. It's true. They do hide it. I mean, but I think that's part of the theme, right? Is you feed the, you feed the masses something that's disgusting and you gussy it up so they can't tell it's disgusting, right? It plays to the underlying themes of the movie, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. You oppress them in so many other ways.
Right.
Let's see. So as they make their way forward, they get to a certain point in the train where it's interesting to sort of see kind of the different levels of guards that they run into along the way. And this is, I don't know, again, maybe a little video game-ish in my mind, but it works. It's like you have the guards with no bullets in their guns at the back of the train. And they're there to like stand around and be tough and like beat people up and maybe stick somebody's hand out the window to freeze it off every once in a while. And then you have like the people who are actually there to beat people to death, which is who they encounter next, with like bludgeons and machetes and various other sort of nasty handheld weapons. And in this particular train car where they encounter this kind of level up of guards, they realize that they're about to go through a tunnel.
Yeah, and this is a great scene because it's really looking like Chris Evans and those guys have the advantage, right? They're standing at opposite ends of this train car. It has big windows outside, and you really, Chris Evans and the guys are thinking like, we things are going pretty well here.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, sure, it's a bunch of like, badass looking guards with hand weapons, but also like they picked up a lot of their own weapons along the way, and they've kind of proven themselves, and they're like, okay, this is maybe at least a fair fight.
Right.
And then they go into a tunnel, and
instantly the entire situation is upended and our heroes are screwed.
Yeah. Cause, it turns out the guards have night vision goggles, which is a thing that they have, maybe just for this reason. Like, why do they have them? Who knows? But there they are.
Well, Tilda Swinton's character, you can tell something bad is coming because she's in a very good mood, right? And I should say, it's not clear the gender identity of her character. Her character's a little, it's not obvious. I'll say she, but they definitely have a cat that ate the canary look on their face during the scene. And you're like, why are they so happy? And you're like, oh crap.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's because, they're about to get their first like real major setback, along the way. It's an amazing, amazingly filmed, fight scene. And I think this is maybe a place to highlight one of the more interesting ways in which this is filmed, which is that even in this chaotic fight scene in the dark with night vision and stuff, the movie is filmed in such a way that the back of the train is always to the viewer's left and the front of the train is always to the viewer's right.
Oh, okay.
And so no matter what's happening throughout the entire movie, that is maintained. And so you always know whether someone's making progress or losing ground.
Is that, what about when they're going through the roundabout, they're going down and they're doing a loop. And I thought they showed from the other side because they're showing, because they're showing the people that are at the front of the train firing back at the back of the train.
Oh yeah,
through the windows. I think that may be the one time when that rule is done differently. But when they're traveling on a straight line, I think you're right. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. This being our heroes, right? They still make it out of the fight. They bring in some torches to try and level things out. I guess Curtis loses his best friend in this fight.
He has to make a choice, right?
Yeah.
He's got to, you know, choose option A or choose option B. And he chooses option B, which is to go after Tilda Swinton's character, right?
Yeah.
And so his best buddy and lieutenant is killed.
His lieutenant by the name of Edgar, played by Jamie Bell, best known as playing Billy Elliot in the film of that name.
I've never seen Billy Elliot.
You know, me neither. It was big. It was big in, what, 2000, I think?
Yeah, I don't know anything about it. But it put him on the map, for sure.
Yeah, good to know. Good to know that you can come out of being a child actor like that. And
he was also in Fantastic Four with Chris Evans.
Wow.
So I bet you they're buddies, although I don't know that for a fact. They certainly agreed to be in another movie together anyhow. All right, so okay. He's dead.
So he's dead. He basically sacrificed to try and to capture Minister Mason, Tilda Swinton's character. And so they drag her into the next car, which they sort of go through, and they start to see how the other half lives.
Mm-hmm. Things start getting nice.
Yeah. And so you see that, you know, not only is the back half of the train living in squalor, but the front of the train is basically living in opulence, in these, like, you know, beautiful restaurants and hair salons and tailors and nightclubs and all kinds of amazing stuff, which is basically probably what the entire train was supposed to be when it was operating outside of an apocalypse, right?
Right.
And then they come to a classroom. Mm-hmm. And a schoolroom is always a good place to do some exposition and learn some more about the history of the thing that you're in the middle of.
Mm-hmm. Slow things down a little bit from all the combat.
Yeah. The school teacher is played by Allison Pill, who is currently starring on Star Trek Picard. Where she's
was the series is over.
Yes.
And actually she wasn't in the most recent season.
Was she in, she's in season three? Okay. I haven't made it to season three yet. So no spoilers.
She's in season two. She was also amazing. One of the many amazing people in, Scott Pilgrim, right?
Oh yes.
She's great in a bunch of stuff, right?
Yeah. She's fantastic. We get a nice creepy scene of children being indoctrinated into fascism, which is always creepy. And then we get this kind of weird character popping up, which is this bald guy.
The Eggman.
Eggman shows up with a cart full of eggs, because sure, why not? A cart full of eggs.
Who doesn't like eggs?
Yeah. I guess the reason for eating eggs, if you need one, is this is the 18th circumnavigation of the Earth is the point of celebration at this point in time. So that's, and it's one circumnavigation per year, right? So that's 18 years of this train operating and going around the planet. But it's not just eggs. Turns out it's guns, and the guns actually have bullets in them. They were just saving them for when they actually needed them.
Yes, and there's a scene in the classroom. Somebody's playing a cello? Someone's playing an instrument, right? And yeah. Then a string breaks, and the attack occurs commensurate to the spring breaking, and it's this ratcheting up of the tension. And again, this sort of dreamlike quality. It's like, okay, this guy's come through the eggs, and what's going on? And now they're listening to somebody play cello after we've seen all this combat. And it's, you know, almost like this illusion for a moment that some twisted form of civilization might triumph over everything that's going on. And then that illusion is shattered completely.
Yeah. So let's see here. So we still have bullets. And that turns out to be a bad thing for our ragtag crew. Throughout some of this, Mason has had a henchman with her. This guy's name is Franco, I guess. think, I don't remember ever hearing his name in the movie, but basically he's just this
tough guy.
Guy in a suit. Yeah, tough guy in a suit. Played by Vlad Ivanov, a Romanian actor who's been in a little bit of stuff. But this seems to be maybe one of his few English language roles, although I don't know that he has much to say. He's the indestructible tough guy. So he escapes and is now chasing them as they're making their way farther forward.
And importantly, Gilliam gets killed at this point. So, and we see it, right? They broadcast his execution basically to, I don't know what, make Chris Evans more pissed off. Doesn't seem like a great strategy to me, but they broadcast Gilliam getting killed at the back of the train because the guards have somehow gotten back in control. It wasn't really clear to me how they regained control at the back of the train, but they did. Maybe Egghead or Eggman gave them guns. I don't know. But anyhow, bad thing, and Gilliam gets killed, which makes Chris Evans even more mad.
Yeah. And this is when he kills off Mr. Mason.
Yes. Right.
As a quid pro quo.
Yeah, it really was a quid pro quo too, right? It isn't, I mean, it's arguably not his finest moment, right?
Right.
He's just like, well, you killed my guy, so goodbye.
Yeah.
But it's also, you know, we had this brief illusion. Part of it is also, we had this brief illusion that maybe things could return to a civilized, quote unquote, civilized state somehow, some state of not warfare. And I think he's just being like, okay, unconditional warfare is unconditional warfare.
Yeah. And it's, you know, you don't feel bad for Mason at all. She's pretty clearly an evil character through and through. I mean, it doesn't gain him anything either. Like it's pretty clear that, you know, while Mason is in, you know, a position of power, nobody else above her seems to care.
Yeah. Right. She's as dispensable as anybody else.
Yeah.
Right. Only the person at the very top is indispensable. Right. And is the students had been being preached that Wilford, the creator, of the train and the engine and everything here is the only indispensable person. He's, you know, the Stalin figure or, you know, whatever analogy you want to use, but everybody else is dispensable.
So let's see here. We get another couple of interesting scenes of seeing how the other half lives. There's a really great scene in as they go through a aquarium where all the aquaculture is done. There's a scene later where Ed Harris eats a steak, although that's not entirely clear where that steak came from. I don't remember seeing any cows, you know, like miniature cows.
I don't remember cows. No, which isn't to say there weren't. There were supposed to be like 1,000 cars on the train or something like that. It's entirely possible that there were cows who just didn't know about them. It's entirely possible there was people. I mean, who knows, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah.
It's entirely what possible. We know is it wasn't bugs. Like Wilford wouldn't have had to eat bugs. Nobody in the front of the train eats bugs. Not clear what they eat, though.
And then there's some nice scenes in they go through a little rave car. There's a sauna car, and then this is where we have another pretty good fight scene. I think in the kind of sauna car. Is that before or after the circular?
I think the circular thing was first. There's a great scene where the train goes into one of those long sort of roundabout things where if and they have these in Switzerland and other places where if you need to lose altitude quickly, you do basically a big roundabout, right? And the train sort of winds up crossing underneath itself, right? So they've got one of these going on, and the indestructible man is firing at Chris Evans and his group from forward in the train, firing back at them and further back in the train because they can see them through the windows, and he's firing through the windows, and the windows don't completely shatter. They just, you know, little holes get punched through them. So it doesn't vent the entire atmosphere out to the frozen environment, unlike a real glass window. But it's a nifty scene. And then this train straightens out. And yeah, I think that was before the sauna, honestly.
Yeah. Yeah, that would make sense. Yeah, and then in the sauna train, I think is where the guy in a suit, Franco, catches up with Chris Evans. And also with Octavia Spencer's character still there fighting to get her son back after being taken. And this is where I think she gets killed.
Yeah, that's right. She gets killed in the sauna.
Yeah. So basically all that's left is Chris Evans, Curtis, and then Namgung and Yona make their way to the front of the train. And there's a bunch of exposition that happens right before we actually meet the guy at the front of the train. First, we learn that Namgung is not actually a drug addict, or if he is, it's not his primary purpose for collecting all of this drug. It's because it's highly explosive, and his plan is to actually escape the train by causing an explosion and to go out. And the reason that he thinks he can do this is shown in a little bit of a flashback to earlier in the movie, where there's a crashed airplane that you can see out the side of the train. And he says that every year he looks at this crashed airplane, and he sees more and more of the plane being exposed. And so to him, that means that the snow is actually melting. And so that's progress. And he thinks that's good enough to go and chance it. The other bit of exposition is we hear Chris Evans' backstory, which is horrifying. And he basically describes what it was like in the first year or two of being on this train, which basically was horrific cannibalism. He talks about, you know, he's like, the worst memory that he has is knowing that he knows what like baby tastes like.
And he reveals that he was ready to eat Edgar, who later became his sort of second in command, but that Gilliam offered him his arm instead. There's no coming back from killing a baby, right? So
yeah, and I don't know. I got the sense from the way he was talking was that like he had been eating people before that.
I did that too, but not that he had killed people himself. This was him. Going to kill a baby. He was definitely going to kill Edgar himself, and that just seems like there's no coming back from that. But basically, Gilliam helped him not do that, and so that began their closeness.
Yeah.
So then there's a new boss fight, and the new boss fight is a woman named, incongruously, Claude, who may or may not be the partner of Wilford, may or may not be a robot or a synthetic person. I thought Claude was so tough. I thought there was a hint that she might not be human or some sort of android or something. She is really... could take a lot of damage. So there's a boss fight with Claude that continues on for a while stuff is going on.
It sort of ends up with Curtis by himself in the front of the train. Mm-hmm.
With Wilford.
He finally meets Wilford, played by the amazing Ed Harris.
Who you may recognize from just about everything, starting with in two of the best nonfiction movies about space ever made. He is both in The Right Stuff as John Glenn, and he's in Apollo 13 as what's his name? The mission director. Oh, Gene Kranz.
Gene Kranz.
Yeah. So yes. A titan of, and he's been in a bunch of science fiction stuff as well as nonfiction, but just a titan of film. Just an amazing actor.
And in this film, he gets to play the, eccentric billionaire, misunderstood.
Elon Musk, the Elon Musk kind of his generation, yeah. We can say.
Mm-hmm. Yes. This is, if Elon Musk's trains ran on the surface of the Earth instead of
in a vacuum, electric cars that below.
Are supposed to drive through.
Also, if Elon's trains worked.
Yeah, that would, yeah. Exactly. We get a nice, evil villain speech about how, you know, this is all for the good of humanity and
the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few or the one.
Yeah. Yeah. And also, like, hey, since you made it all the way to the front of the train, like, it's time for your final level up. You get to run this thing after I'm gone, basically.
But first, we have a minor issue we have to address. We have to kill 3/4 of the people on the train. It's not, have some math, you know, the equation, you know, the math isn't working out, and we got to do a little bit of, we got to do a tweak to the system. We got to kill 3/4 of the people in the back of the train.
Which, I mean, even from a, like, purely Malthusian perspective, seems really excessive. Like, 3/4 is, that's a lot. That's a shock to the system there.
You have to make a pretty big mistake when you have to get rid of 3/4 of the, of your system. Yeah, in one fell swoop.
It's definitely a, I don't know, punctuated equilibrium kind of approach.
One might speculate that things are not going well on the train if you have to get rid of 3/4 of the people on the train. The experiment is not working very well.
And the shocking reveals come one after another. The 3/4 thing comes as part of the revelation that Gilliam and Wilfred have been working together, basically somehow.
Did you buy that? That was like the one thing in this movie that I was like, I was just like, really? Like, it didn't, I mean, it almost happened in, like, it had almost no impact on the things. What would Gilliam have done differently? I mean, I guess he had some way of communicating with the front. And so the messages that were coming back, like, he was basically telling them to give Chris Evans these messages, right? Is what I guess what it turns out to be. But like, I guess he was helping get rid of the population in the back, and this rebellion of Evans's was going to help get rid of the 3/4 of the people that were in the back of the train. But I just didn't, it felt like it was disconnected from everything else. It's not like you could look at a scene that had occurred previously with John Hurt's character and be like, oh, we thought he meant this, but he really meant that. It was just more like the system is so insidious that it's got corrupted agents everywhere. Is the feel of it?
Yeah. Yeah. Or like, yeah, it's just like, oh, everything you thought you knew, turns out it was all a lie.
That's how insidious the man is.
Yeah.
I would have liked a scene or two that would have meant something different once you knew that his character had different motivations than you thought he did. It just would have made it more like, oh, okay. Huh. Right. This way it was just like, okay. I guess he was a bad guy, but he's dead. So
Yeah. Which also makes his death even more meaningless.
Why did Curtis kill him actually? To try to demotivate, again, whether he was a good guy or a bad guy, killing him, I don't know what it was supposed to accomplish in either way.
Yeah.
It was a little murky on that one. So much of this film is very lean and, you know, no wasted effort, but that plot point just seemed murky to me.
It did, yeah, yeah. But I think, you know, it speaks to the, I don't know, this seems to come up in Bong Joon-ho movies, right? It's just like not quite the banality of evil, but just the, like, you just have to set the scene of like, well, these are just terrible people, and they're going to choose, you know, given the option of how terrible they want to be, they're going to choose probably the most terrible way to do it.
Yeah, although it's interesting, Ed Harris, I mean, the way this Curtis character is written, and the way that he plays it is definitely to divorce himself from the worst of the horror in the back. I mean, he's definitely supposed to be the modern scientific dictator who does everything according to an equation and doesn't get his hands dirty, right? Has levels of insulation from having to do the dirty work himself. Although he's perfectly happy to have some weird stuff going on inside the engine. But it's, you know, it's just so civilized up front, right? They think about him eating the steak, and he talks about everything in a very philosophical and clinical way for something that's really monstrously horrible, which I think is a statement, again, like you say, not the banality of evil, but certainly the scientific method applied to horrible totalitarian life in the 21st century.
Yeah. And then the other sort of terrible revelation that we find in the engine car is that it turns out, while this is a perpetual motion kind of device, it turns out that everything breaks down over time. And there's been some irreplaceable parts that have broken down and have needed to be replaced by a child.
Someone small enough to fit in the right place in the vehicle. So that's why they wanted kids. Circling back to the first scene in the movie, to act as human cogs in the machine.
Yeah. And so at that point, and so this is, you know, this is one of the kids that they came up to try and rescue, as sort of one of the kind of the side quest.
This is Timmy, the son of Octavia Spencer.
Yes. And, so this is sort of what knocks Curtis out of his, at least thinking about maybe taking Ed Harris's offer.
Yeah. He's tempted.
Or at least being, kind of, at least entranced by it maybe a little bit. Cause he's already established, like he's morally, he's maybe a little bit ambiguous.
Yeah. He's a complicated, like all of this director's characters in all of their movies and all of Bong Joon-ho's movies. He's a morally complicated character.
Yeah. Rather than take over the train and work with Ed Harris, he goes to rescue Timmy and gets his arm cut off in the process.
Mangled by the machine. Yes,
I think this is the third arm that gets destroyed in some way in this movie. Yeah, and then with Timmy rescued, there's also this big fight scene that's continuing in what would be what kind of the Stoker car, the car behind the engine car.
Yeah. And it's a girls versus girls, boys versus boys, which is in some ways kind of a cop out to me. Like if you've got a female antagonist, you have to have a female protagonist fight the female antagonist, because God help you if you have a guy punch a woman. Right. So Yona fights with Claude, the may or may not be a cyborg. And, the guy whose name it's hard to pronounce, fights with the guy who's an unstoppable killing machine.
Yes.
Namgong fighting with, what's his name?
Yeah. Which takes us to, what do you call it? Chekhov's chewing gum.
Right.
Does finally go off and blows a hole in the side of the train, knocks the train off the track.
Yep. Well, before that, let me just mention the other little boy shows up.
Oh yeah.
Andy, the son of the guy whose arm got frozen off at the beginning. And he crawls out of a nook and then goes and climbs into a space inside the engine in the front. And it's just more of an example of like, this whole system is rotten and corrupt and has to go, right? There's just no, you know, There's no redeeming this system, right? It's yet another signpost towards that conclusion.
Yeah. I haven't dug much into the graphic novel. I might try and see if there's a English translation available. There might be. To see if the thing with the kid is part of the original story or if that was added. Because it directly references the short story called "The Ones Who Walk Away from Omelas," which is by Ursula K. Le Guin. You can read it online. It's a pretty short movie or a pretty short short story, and you know, not to spoil a 1973 short story. There's basically a conceit of like, there's this beautiful utopian society that's described through the story. And toward the very end, you are told that like the whole reason that this utopian society is able to be utopian society is that there is one child that is kept in squalor, like in a basement somewhere. And lives like an abject, horrible life. And everybody in the society goes to see this child as part of a ritual. And they either go back to their life, or they're like, screw it, we're out, and they leave. And so I thought that was a really, like, it has to be a reference to that short story, because it's been around for so long.
I think that Star Trek Brave New Worlds did a take on that story. I don't know if they credited Le Guin, but they did a very similar thing in their first season.
Nice.
But anyhow.
So yeah, and that's sort of like one of the questions, right? Of like, what do you do? And you're like, well, either this train needs to keep running to keep, you know, however many, do they ever list the number of people on this train?
No, I don't. Really do. I don't think they did. I mean, they said it was 1,000 cars. I don't know what that tells you for how many people.
Yeah, but this is it. This is
10,000.
This is humanity. This is all that's left. And so, like, how much atrocity do you put up with to make it work? And it's obviously Wilford's approach that, like, some amount of atrocity is required, right? And the specific one for him is like, there's no way to replace this part, so I must put a child inside the engine and force them to work on it. You could maybe come up with reasons why, you know, literally everything else on the train could maybe be a little bit more, I don't know, equal. But like in his sort of twisted engineering utopia mind, like there's no other solution to keeping this train running.
But we're not going to get to find out whether that would have been a good or a bad idea. Because as you allude to, Namgong sets off his collected gum explosive.
And the train derails, blows a hole in the side of the train.
In an amazing scene.
Oh, yeah.
I just have to say, one of the 10 best scenes, I will say, in any science fiction movie ever is this, because we've seen this world, this linear world set up over the course of the previous hour and a half, right? And they show, they move to the outside world in a way that they really haven't shown the outside world very much for very long previously. But you very much see the train in its environment, and it is traveling through a big mountainous area, and the explosion doesn't just blow a hole in the side of the train, it also sets off a avalanche, right?
Yeah.
And the avalanche is what actually derails the train. Yeah. And oh my God, is it just, it's just such an amazing scene. And you just see from the perspective of various people that you've met along the way in very quick succession, what it's like to be on the train as it's getting knocked off by a gigantic avalanche. Yeah.
And it's maybe not super clear how many people actually survive the derailments.
I mean, most of those cars are sent off into the abyss, yeah, right? Because they're on a steep mountainside. You see most of the cars go careening down the hillside in a way that guarantees that nobody survived.
Yeah.
Right. You're right. It's not absolutely clear that every single other person other than a couple of characters has died. But and it sort of makes it, you know, it'd make for an interesting story if there were some survivors,
yeah,
but
yeah,
there won't be many.
Right. Which kind of speaks to like what was Namgun planning? Like, did he care? Like what else, what was his, you know, what did he trade?
He just wanted off the train, man.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And so sort of the worst case, right, view of this is two people survive.
Yes.
Right. It was, you know, Yona.
Because Curtis and Namgong protect, shield with their bodies.
Yeah.
Yona and Timmy.
So that's kind of the worst case scenario, is there are two humans left alive on the planets.
It could be that bad.
But they do see at least some vindication of Namgung's understanding of what's going on, because they look up and they see a polar bear.
Mm-hmm.
And a fairly healthy looking one, you know. This is, you know, it's an apex predator, which implies Okay, there's a polar bear.
It's had things to eat over the intervening decades.
There's probably some mammals that it's been eating, and there's probably some things for those mammals to eat, and on down. So
it's what would in a different movie be shown by butterflies or birds or some other. Hey, life is returning, and in this case, it's a 1,400 pound apex carnivore.
Yeah, which there's a look in Timmy's eye which could maybe be interpreted a couple of ways, and I don't know, I'm probably reading way too much into it, which is either like, huh, that's interesting, I wonder what that is, or I'm not sure what that is, but it's probably going to eat me.
Yeah, there was some ambiguity in that scene, wasn't there? I agree with you. I thought that the whole thing about the polar bear, I think on some level it's just like life is messy, right? And if you're gonna blow your way out of a train in the middle of a global, climate pandemic, whatever, there's gonna be a lot of challenges from day one, right? Day one, hour one, minute one is the fact that a gigantic 1,400 pound apex carnivore is looking down at you from a mountain ridge, right?
Yeah.
And it's probably hungry.
Yeah.
But you also can tell they're going to get stuff out of the train, right? Their part of the train is wrecked, but it isn't blown to smithereens, right? So they're going to be able to get, because she gets a parka for both of them, right?
Yeah.
She finds some winter gear. So there's like, they have a chance. It's not that they're doomed. Right. That's definitely, the polar bear was not friendly. It was not a cuddly polar
bear. Right. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. There could have been any number of other animals or indications or anything else to say like, yes, this is an okay choice. But this,
right. They could have shown a reindeer.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And then,
or a caribou.
Yeah. And then they're great.
But they didn't.
Cause that's meat at that point. Mm-hmm. And that's it. And that's the end. That's all you get. Mm-hmm. It's left.
No extraneous exposition at the end of this movie.
No, there's no post-credit sequence, showing an aged Chris Evans, going off into the sunset or anything like that.
No, he's dead. He and Nam Gong are definitely dead because she cries over Nam Gong, right? They're definitely dead. But only the two innocents, only the two people who have like no culpability in this system at all survive, right?
Yeah. So that's Snowpiercer.
What does it all mean, Tim?
What does it all mean? I think I'd recommended this because when did this movie come out? About 10 years ago, actually, 2013. And it does the thing that Bong Joon-ho does so well, which is to find something about society and how it's organized and make a compelling science fiction movie about it.
Yeah, I mean it's a pretty direct critique of capitalism, right? And of meritocracy, quote unquote meritocracies. And the unequal distribution of power and wealth in our world. None of that stuff is particularly subtle, but it's also not, I mean, it's overt, but it's not didactic or cliched, right?
Yeah.
It's an interesting new take on the subject.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I would say I would put it in the family of movies like 1984, like THX 1138, things like that show a post-apocalyptic, stratified fascist type society. But shrunk down to this, like the size of the movie, I think is maybe what makes it so interesting. Is that it raises the stakes so much. Like you could theoretically, like even though we don't really know how many people might be on this train, like you could theoretically know everybody's names on that train.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody on this train would probably actually bother to know everybody's names.
No, but they say each of us knows maybe 1,000 people, right? Yeah. If they say degrees of separation, order of magnitude, we know 1,000 people. Could you know if all 1,000 people in this train? Sure.
Yeah. And it the other interesting thing for me is just this idea of one engineering's ability to cause bigger problems than it solves, or really, the people that use engineering solutions, in ways that cause more problems than what they were intending to solve. And also, a tool is a tool. It's how you use it that makes it good or terrible. Mm-hmm. You know, there are certainly ways that a society stuck on a train like this could have been organized in a way that was egalitarian and, you know, whatever else. But I think what Bong Joon-ho is saying is that because it started as a kind of like pleasure train for the rich, there's only one way that that society could have ended up because that stratification was there from the very beginning.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. And I don't know if I've ever mentioned this in our podcast, and if I have, forgive me, but P.G. O'Rourke wrote a long time ago about El Salvador. This is a sort of a weird segue, but he talked about how settlements in the quote unquote New World were generally founded one of two ways. Either religious whack jobs who were trying to get away from the authorities and practice their religion the way they wanted, or second sons of royalty and the nobility who weren't going to inherit the estate, so they had to go make it on their own. And the second sons of nobility basically usually made cash extraction engines, right? So places like North Carolina, with the crops there, Virginia as well, Central America was Honduras and Guatemala and El Salvador. And then the religious whack jobs tended to make colonies that were self-sufficient and designed to be in the long term. And so Massachusetts is an example of that. Costa Rica is an example of that. I don't remember where else were his examples. But his point was that the things that were designed to be exploitative from the word go have continued to generally follow an exploitation model. And the places that were designed to be self-sufficient are usually the nicer places in the Western Hemisphere. I mean, all these things were built on the backs and bodies of the Native Americans who lived here before them. But nonetheless, places that were designed to be self-sufficient are generally still pretty decent places to live, and places that were designed to exploit continue to exploit. And so that would be another... he would agree, I think, were he still alive, and he's not. He died a couple of years ago, with your assessment of how this train was set up.
Yeah.
The inherent in its architecture, you can't move beyond the original purpose. It's sort of cooked into the system, and so it's not surprising that it wound up continuing to be exploitive. I mean, it's a pretty bleak statement on capitalism. I don't know if I agree with everything that it says about capitalism, but... you could certainly read it as capitalism always produces winners and losers, and those winners and losers will build the systems that they, perpetuate their own power.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't know, I kind of see this particular society as not even, I guess maybe it could be post-capitalist. Right.
Yeah, you're right. It isn't explicitly capitalist, but yeah, it is definitely the resource. Uneven distribution of wealth, right? Uneven distribution of resources.
Yeah, yeah. It almost feels almost, I don't know, like Soviet Russia kind of an organization. And then it's a very planned society kind of a deal.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, it isn't necessarily. It's not like there's merchants here. I mean, it's a totalitarian cult with just one person at the very top. It'd be interesting to see the TV show. I don't know anything about it other than... It's Sean Bean who plays the Ed Harris character, right? In the isn't it in the TV show?
It's got a great cast. David Diggs, Jennifer Connelly.
Yeah, Jennifer Connelly's amazing. I don't know too much about the TV show. What else do we want to say about this movie?
I talked a little bit about the. The sustainability aspects of it, and where does the steak come from and stuff. You're probably right; it's probably people. I guess the other thing is like trains running on tracks. I was thinking about this today. It's like if you're only running across a stretch of track once a year, what's going to happen to that stretch of track between now and the next time you come across it?
Yeah, because they had a scene early on where they have to go through a avalanche.
Yeah,
and the train has all sorts of systems on board to deal with that. But you and I know in the Pacific Northwest, you get you can have avalanches around here or landslides. They don't have anything to do with snow. It's just a mountain comes down on the train tracks, right? Yeah. And there's ain't no amount of diggers on the front of your train are gonna deal with a mountain in front of you covering your tracks. So there's a element of that that's not really believable.
Yeah, but again, you know, it's a train, so like the train works as metaphor.
So are we ready to give it a score?
Yeah, let's do that.
So we do science, we do fiction, and we do film.
So let's see. So for science, I think, like I was talking about with the train, and being able to run on tracks once a year, there's definitely some things that aren't fully, I don't know, believable. I'd say overall, I'd probably give it, I'm going to say 80. Give it an 80.
80. All right. I gave it 75. But similar, I think for similar reasons, you know, I don't think, I think it wants to put it within a, there's a lot of movies that want to not be fantasy, but beyond that, they're just fine not being fantasy. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? In the spectrum between fantasy and science fiction, they're like, no, we're firmly in the science fiction. But like beyond that, we're not going to go trying to explain every single little thing in here, right? And I think of it as if they ever get their asses in gear and make a Pern movie mm-hmm. series, right? Anne McCaffrey clearly wanted Pern to be science fiction, not a fantasy novel about dragons, and went to great lengths to try to put the science around her science fiction. But, you know, but then in the end, it's got castles and dragons and, you know, damsels in distress and, you know, super bad villains and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, versus something that's like a Michael Crichton, you know, extremely hard sci-fi or Neal Stephenson, right? Something where it's like all the science is meticulously mapped out, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. How does it work as fiction?
As fiction, I'm going to give it an 85. I think, you know,
okay.
like we were talking about, there's some bits in the story that kind of don't fully close, but like as a story, like this is compelling storytelling. The way in which they make their way from the back of the train to the front and the way that we learn about the character's evolution, is like, that's some great storytelling.
Yeah. And here again, I'm 5 points behind you, right? I said 80% for me. You know, I had trouble with the whole Gilliam thing. I had trouble with how quickly the guards regained the upper hand in the back part of the train. I thought some of that was a little bit murky, like the stuff, everything that has to do with Chris Evans and Tilda mm-hmm. Swinton and everything that had to do with Ed Harris, I thought was all crisply done. I thought it was fine. I mean, 80% is a good number for me. But again, just a couple of ticks behind you on that one. Film?
I got to give this one I'm going to give it a 95. I think this is a great movie.
95.
I mean, this is, you know, from something as simple as, you know, the way in which the camera movements are staged, like I was talking about earlier, to just the crampedness of how everything was filmed to, like, make you feel that you're stuck on this train with these people, and just the pacing and everything else. Like it's a fantastic film.
Yeah. I'll give it, I would give it 95% also. Again, there were scenes in here, you know, to be at 95%, you have to have some scenes that you've just never seen anything like it before. And it's some of the best that there's been. And that the whole avalanche scene at the end is just masterful. And there's other scenes in it that are extremely well done. And all the visual design stuff is beautiful and streamlined. And, you know, it could have been really, to be stuck on a train for an hour and a half or 2 hours could have just felt really claustrophobic. And it doesn't at all. And that's just stunningly good visuals. So I'm with you at 95%. So that gives us 78%. 83% and 95%.
Cool.
So what do we want to do as a next film? And you know, I sent you a suggestion today.
Yeah. Aniara.
Are you familiar with Aniara?
I am not, but I am looking it up right now and am intrigued.
I will say it would be the most bummer of a film we've ever written. It's very much science fiction, but 71% on Rotten Tomatoes, impeccable production design. Metacritic is only 61%. It's won some awards in Sweden, won some awards at international at the Trieste Science Fiction Festival. Commitment to bleakness feels artistically admirable. To set the stage. Wow.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. It would be quite unlike anything that we've reviewed before.
I mean, I've got the Wikipedia page open, and I think they had me at adaptation of a Swedish epic poem. I mean,
yes.
No.
Yeah. We'll have to read. How long is the poem? I wonder. Is it like a book length poem? Because I feel like I'm up for reading the poem as well. Aniara, Swedish book length epic science fiction poem. You know, I don't know if you know this about me, Tim, but I submitted and won, I think I came in second place, a science fiction competition at the University of Minnesota, my first senior year, as opposed to my second senior year, in the engineering program with a science fiction poem.
Ooh, very good. Well.
So perhaps
I have also had poetry published in both high school and college. So I'm in.
Oh my God! So we have to do this then. Clearly,
I think that's it. Yep,
that's the sign. The book length epic science fiction poem written by Swedish Nobel laurate Harry Martinson.
Okay. Oh, an influence yes. on A Fire Upon the Deep by Werner Vinge, which is one of my favorite science fiction stories. So, all right, we're doing this one. So,
all right, there we go. All right, we're in for this nihilistic, angsty science fiction movie. So, all right, I'll have to figure out how to maintain my boyish enthusiasm for the universe as I delve into the subject. All right, well, thank you so much for leading our discussion through this, and thank you everyone at home for listening to the podcast. I will get on this and get this. Done this just as soon as I get back from Texas, where I'm doing a thing next weekend. But I'll be back shortly, and then I'll get this done in the next couple weeks.
Fantastic. Well, yeah. And until next time, I was going to say be the shoe, but actually don't be the shoe. You shouldn't be the shoe. You should be whatever article of clothing you want to be.
But you should keep watching science fiction films. Thank you so much for listening to another episode of The Monty Hall Effect. Our musical themes were written and performed by Guy Ellis. If you have any thoughts, feedback, or questions about the podcast, you can contact us at themontyhalleffect@gmail.com. Thanks, and keep watching science fiction films.